Hello, we're back after our little hiatus over the holidays, and we have a brilliant first podcast of the year for you. We've got the wonderful Kate Thornton. Now, interestingly, we recorded this a few weeks ago, right before she began recording her own podcast, which is called White Wine Question Time, which is absolutely brilliant. Check it out if you haven't already. It's full of just warmth and wit and wonderfulness, as was, I think, our podcast with Kate. She was very open and spoke, you know, very poignantly about her experiences with bullying, resilience, how she got through it. She spoke about her eating disorders, and she also spoke about becoming a mom and what that's meant to her. So really hope you enjoy this podcast. I certainly did. Listen, I'm delighted that you're here because one of the things that I've been trying to do with the podcast is talk to people with interesting stories to kind of explain what goes on behind the scenes. I think we fetishize success. I think we fetishize the ease with which, you know, people appear happy, appear well-adjusted. And
I would agree with that entirely. Yeah. It's not a ready meal. It's a feast. It takes a lot to put that together. It really does. And we do. We simplify it. And we're sending out probably really unhealthy messages about how attainable whatever your perception of success is. And for me, my definition of success is happiness. I think you can overcomplicate it, but I do think we make it look way too we fast tracked it, and there's no fast track. It's a marathon, I'm sad to say, not a sprint.
And I think you raise an interesting point of what it looks like success, because happiness it seems fundamental, but how is that intertwined with being valued by others? How is it intertwined between, you know, with material worth, with ticking boxes in terms of how you look, especially as a woman, and ticking boxes in terms of all of those things?
So much of it, But I mean, for me, the definition is really quite simple. If I'm happy, then I'm happy to jump out of bed in the morning and embrace the day. If I wake up and think, oh, God, really not looking forward to today, then I'm not succeeding.
Yeah. What do you do on those days when you wake up and it's difficult to get out of bed?
I can't really remember the last time I had one. I'm a bit of a solutions person. I'm a total renovator. I will try and renovate any situation, any property, any person. I'm a doer-upper. I quite thrive on problems, probably, to some degree. I work better when I'm stressed, but in a healthy way, not stressed. They always say, don't they, give a busy person a job and they'll get it done. I'm much better busier. If I've only got three things to do across a day, I will procrastinate and I become quite lethargic. Yeah. And I'm really not very happy unless I'm tasked, which is not always a great thing. I'm not advertising that as being, you know, a great mindset to live in, because it can be a very double-edged sword.
But that kind of idea of goal direction, again, psychologically speaking, makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense for a couple of reasons. Number one, it gives you a barometer, right?
Yeah.
Of what I've accomplished versus what I haven't. And I think that, you know, I think as human beings, we need those rulers, those barometers to some extent. I think sometimes you're right, we overuse them, but, you know, a bit of it's okay.
It's a bit of structure, isn't it?
it's a bit of structure,
An anatomy of who you believe you can be. Well, and if you go back to that kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is kind of just a really simple way to illustrate mankind and what they're capable of, but only if they have everything else in place. So it's a bit like building a house. You need firm foundations, so you need food and shelter before you can get to the top of that triangle of need, which is actualization.
Yeah.
And actualization is really, I mean, we're talking in all of these kind of, you know, fancy terms, is about having the capacity to be the best version of you that you can be. And you can only do that if you know that the rent's paid and the kids are fed and that the basics are taken care of. And I think for every human being has it in them to be the best version of themselves they can be, but only if they have the tools around them to be able to do that.
And we forget that, don't we? I can't tell you how many people sit across from me, really, you know, intelligent, well-adjusted people that forget the basics, forget to eat, to move, to sleep.
Self-care.
Well, it becomes, because, you know, we live in such a competitive time, so I think people see burnout as a badge of honor. I've had conversations with friends that, you know, I'm sleeping 5 hours a night. We think, well, how sustainable is that?
Yeah, you're right, it's not a badge of honor. And even right back to when I first started working in journalism. There was a badge of honor in being the first in and the last out of the office. Yeah, well, yeah. That, if you go to other parts of the world, that's seen as derisory. Yeah, that's seen as unproductive because it is.
Yeah.
So you go to the Scandi countries where they think, well, if you're still in the office at six, you're clearly not working well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there is sense in that.
Absolutely. But you're so right. But I think a lot of these things we kind of bring from over the pond. Every time when I'm in the States, it's fascinating where I've had conversations about people competing about how few days they take holiday. And I'm like, well, I take as many days as I can.
I go on as many holidays as possible. Because life is short. And it's about those are the moments that make it all worthwhile. You know, there is nothing better than sitting watching the shore wash in and out with the people you love next to you at the end of a day where you've done nothing particularly really, just being together.
Together. But I think this is it. This is the balance. And one of the worries that I have is this: so much of the world, that when I look at it, and I'd love to hear your perspective on this, seems very polarized. I do a lot of work with eating disorders, so I find it fascinating when I speak to girls that are either starving themselves or just eating to the point where it's unhealthy. So there's no balance there. I see it in politics, that you're either completely to the left or completely to the right. We've got lost sort of a happy meeting. Yeah. I see it with work ethic. So either, you know, I'm burning out or I'm just going to, you know, binge on Netflix for that. There seems to have been this kind of polarization of our ability to kind of find balance.
Well, it's like moderation's become a dirty word, and actually moderation is what we should all try and strive for. Because I don't do diets because I have a history of eating disorders, so I feel that I know those extremities well, certainly on a psychological level, because an eating disorder is first and foremost a mental illness. And I know how debilitating and hurtful and harmful that can be, not just to you, but the people that love you. So actually, from the age of about 17, I have grappled with moderation and always tried to use that as my anchor. So I don't drink to excess, but I drink every day, moderately. Yeah. I don't exercise to excess. I can do. I have that in me to be quite competitive with myself. But I try to exercise at least 3 or 4 times a week. So it's moderate.
So tell me how you keep it moderate. Because people listening be like, great, well, that's the idea.
You have a word to yourself. You have to, you know, I mean, I say this, a lot of work, actually, you know, over the years. When I first, so going right back to the first time where I had to do any kind of, you know, introversion or looking at myself and trying to better who I was as a teenager now with eating disorders. So I was an anorexic and a bulimic. And that was as a response, really, to feeling horribly out of control because I was being bullied at school. And I didn't realise that, actually, until very recently when I went and made a documentary about this, about eating disorders, because I thought that, you know, it was just a reaction to being a slightly chubby teenager with a bit of puppy fat, as we call it. Just such a horrible expression, so ugly. And actually, it wasn't. It was in response to the fact that I was being picked on and bullied in a new school. I mean, quite horribly, where the police were called in and I was, you know, there were death threats. It was quite extreme. And I was beaten up, physically beaten up every Wednesday. So resilience, I think, my resilience starts with that. Because up until then, I'd had a very gilded, lovely, regular life with parents that loved me, a huge family that was supportive, loving, full of laughter. And then this happened, and that was kind of the first hand grenade that was thrown in my path. And I remember being beaten up every Wednesday, but my friends that became my friends as a result of that, when I sat down and interviewed them about that for this documentary, I felt very defeated by those weekly beatings. And they said, no, do you not remember that you would be on the floor and they would be, you know, pummeling you, hitting you, but still I would be, I mean, effectively gobbing off at them. So literally this girl's punching me and I'm telling her she's got fat ankles. Because that was all I had, was words. I was never going to raise my fist to another human being. I find it heinous as a thought that I would want to hurt physically another human being, even if they're hurting me. So all I had really was words, and that's probably, you know, says a lot about the choices that I've made in my life ever since. But that was probably my first experience of having to be resilient, because I had to go into school every day and I get these calls. I mean, we used to have a whistle by our phone at home, so that when they called with these kind of horrible phone calls, we would just blow a whistle down the phone to them.
So it followed you, because we speak a lot today about how cyberbullying is different for kids, right? I do a lot of work in this area, and one of the big things we say is that you literally can't escape it. But you're saying even back then they would call you.
They would call the house. They would call the house. Because, you know, you could easily find people's phone numbers in the phone book back then. And the phone would go. And I, even as I'm saying it to you now, I can feel the fear of looking at that handset and thinking, oh God, it's going to be them, or maybe it's not, maybe it's my Auntie Carol, you know, but that fear of lifting that the handset to my ear. And then when it was them, I'm thinking, like, come on, dig deep, get that whistle, blow it down, just don't. And then having to go and sit in class with them day in, day out. That's resilience.
That is resilience. How did it resolve? Did you have support around you? But obviously your family, did the teachers, were they on top of it? How it happened?
No.
So how long did this go on for?
Oh, years.
Years?
Years and years, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Did you ever confront them?
Yeah.
Did you?
Every week when they hit me. There's one woman in particular, but many, many, many years later, when I was an adult, I was back at home and I was driving and I recognized our ankles because I'd spent a lot of time on the floor staring at our ankles as she beat me, as she hit me. And I just pulled up next to her in my car, and I won't use her name because hopefully she's grown into a better adult than she was maybe a teenager. But I said, hey, I thought it was you. She just looked mortified, and, you know, she had lots of children with her, so I wasn't going to be unkind. And she said, how did you know it was me? I said, the ankles. But no, I've never kind of, you know, sought revenge or anything like that, because I don't believe in that. I think, you know, if I'm being generous, I think that that person and those people had their own issues that unfortunately manifested themselves in the way they dealt with me or treated me. Mm-hmm. And that's their bad, not mine.
Indeed, that's their bad. But also, I've got to say, feel that we have responsibility of how we deal with our issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a care of duty, certainly in schools now. I mean, my mum and dad were all over it, and the school to some degree, but not in a way that affected change. And I, you know, now that those people would be removed from that school. Yeah. That just didn't happen back then. You're it's the 80s, you know, I'm 500 years old. So it was a long, long time ago. And I certainly would never allow any child of mine to suffer the indignity of that experience. And so what I did in response to being bullied like that, I suppose, is I fought back verbally, but I tried to shrink so that I thought maybe they were picking on me because I was large or because of the way I looked. So I just thought, if I shrink, they won't see me anymore. So I stopped eating. And not eating became a form of control in a life that felt horribly out of my control.
Yeah.
It makes sense when you break it down like that, right? I'm trying to control everything that's going on around me. And the one thing I'm succeeding at is shrinking and not eating. Yeah. And then realizing that I am in a very brutal competition with myself on this. I mean, the behaviours, and I always become quite mindful of not discussing too much about how I starved myself, because then it becomes a bit of a manual and a how-to to maybe a vulnerable man or woman or girl or boy listening that will then apply those tactics to their own eating disorders.
Well, sadly, these days there's pro-Anna, pro-Mia sites that unfortunately are still left on, which is just, I think, so unbelievably unethical.
Exactly. Then that goes back to living in a world where we're perceived to be having, you know, a democratic world where we have the ability to speak freely, and they would argue that that is their freedom.
Well, no, because there's parameters even on freedom of speech, right?
Yeah.
We have the internet.
It's difficult.
The idea that you can't enforce parameters.
And the internet is so unpoliced and yada,
well,
yada.
Yeah, so I just think everyone kind of hides behind that. But yeah,
I try to be responsible in not kind of providing the granularity about how I did that to myself.
Sure.
But I did do some extreme things that were incredibly unhealthy, both mentally and physically, and must have been awful for my parents to try to navigate at a time when there was very little information around eating disorders. You know, my dad would say things like, just eat. And I was like, if only it was that simple, Dad. Whereas my mum kind of got it. And in the end, we just lucked out. And that's the sad fact of stories like mine or other people with eating disorders, is you need the right help at the right time, delivered to you by the right person. And for me, it was a GP who just said, I'm not going to write you a prescription, I'm going to talk to you. And that was my first experience of kind of talking therapies. Yeah. And I talked to myself better about that, and the threat of hospitalization, which takes away your control. And by that point as well, I was exhausted. You know, my periods had stopped. I was growing hair on my body that should not have been there, which is what the body does when it's trying to keep you warm. My grades were dropping at school because I was starving my brain of oxygen, everything. I was just starving myself. I was damaging myself. And I just thought, you know what? I've got more, there's more to my body than how it looks. actually the most important body part is your brain. Yeah. And I was killing it. And my brain is, I thought, right, I've got a brain, I'm going to use it.
Because it was about hanging your identity on something else. I kind of think identity construction when it comes to young people especially, and control and decisions, is key. And I think especially for girls, I feel that we put, you know, we teach them to put so many of their self-esteem eggs in the beauty basket and not in the intelligence, or like the body, like you said, functional versus aesthetic. Yeah, the legs might look great, but if you can't run and jump, like, well, good, what's the point?
And also, I think, you know, you start, I certainly achieved a weight that I thought would make me happy, and it didn't. I'd never been more miserable, more exhausted, more guilty of living just a life of lies. Lying to everybody, including myself, that actually by the time I was rumbled and marched to the doctor, I couldn't look at my parents and see the hurt that I was causing them. And I just thought, it doesn't matter, you know, who cares what size my waist is? And actually, who cares about those girls that pick on me every Wednesday at the bus stop? Screw them, screw the lot of you, I'm going to get on with my life. And I'm gonna use my brain to get myself out of this mess, because no one else is going to do it for me. And I think I even realized that at 14 years of age.
Yeah.
So I did.
And that was kind of that sort of like almost like a seminal moment where like a light bulb
went off. The most seminal, because now I am in touch with women. I don't have any men that I kind of have dialogue with on this, but it's certainly a very male issue as well. But I have friends in my life and women in my life who are still living and functioning anorexics. Mm. And I don't want to be that. I would never have had my son had I stayed on that path, because my body would never have been in a position to be able procreate. And without that, honestly, right now, my life would not be even 10% of the joy that it is.
Yeah, because this is it. It's like, you know, where do you put that energy, right? Mm. And we've been duped. One of my favorite quotes is kind of similar, but not exactly. So I think it's Nyusha Prada was asked about Botox or something, and she said something to the effect of, darling, if you want to have sex till you're 100, you don't need Botox. You need to make a lot of money and do well in business. And I'm like, hell yeah.
Exactly.
And I think we sell this toxic idea that, and look, it's, if you want to be very basic about it, it's a basic exchange of commodities, your youth and beauty for, you know, someone else's access to power and money, yeah. Right? And because, you know, if, not to over kind of get on an economic sort of feminist thing, but we know that in societies, anthropologically, where women hold the economic power, we know that these kind of things don't exist. We actually tend to find that men do things like have beauty contests, because that's where they commodify. So we need to kind of find a way that, look, absolutely, I always say, like, I love my highlights, right? I love my PhD a hell of a lot more, right? So by all means, lip gloss, great.
Exactly. And I think that's where I'd got to with it as well. I thought, if I can channel this determination that I've thrown into starving myself into something more productive, the world is my oyster. It's about where I choose to put that determination and that conviction.
Yeah.
And I turned it to, I thought, right, I'm going to get the grades that I need to get into journalism school. I was also quite blessed in as much as I knew from a really early age what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a writer.
You knew right away.
I knew. I loved words. I love reading. I'm a bookaholic. Always have been. I was that kid that had a torch under their duvet when my mum had said lights out. That was just like just one more chapter. And I think also what helped me is that the role models that turned me on, as well as being the kind of supermodels of the day that I really wanted to look like, but I knew I never would, were smart women. You know, they turned me on, and it wasn't about how they looked. It was about what they did and what they said and what they believed. So I managed to move out of that very superficial worship of how somebody looks and put it in more into how they think and what they do and what they achieve and what they change. And then once you identify those people as your role models, the next obvious step is to emulate that.
Yeah.
Which is what I tried to do.
And with a lot of success.
With varying degrees.
Come on. So you get your first big break. Was it at Smash Hits? Was that the first big one?
I'd been at journalism school in London at the London College of Printing, as it was then, the London Institute now. And as part of my qualification, I had to get work experience on two publications.
Okay.
And I wrote to everyone, literally, you know, any publication, you know, me and my dog, right up to The Guardian and The Times and anything that sat in between. And I was accepted by the Mirror Group to go and work on their Sunday supplement. And I think the other one was a women's magazine. And I literally went in there and I thought, right, you know, I've got no money. I couldn't afford a university education. It would have been way too much for my parents to support. And back then, you know, you had to kind of, you know, pay your way through, which you do now. So I thought, right, I've got a year in London to study journalism. And at the end of that, I've got to walk away with the job. Otherwise, I have to go back home. And there's no newspapers back home. I'd already done the local newspaper. I'd got a job. A job on the local newspaper doing payroll for the paper boys and girls. So, you know, the girls and boys that used to go out and deliver them through people's letterboxes.
She was like, 25p for you and 47 for
totally,
you.
Totally, right? It was the free newspapers. But what it enabled me to do when I was interviewed to get into journalism college, because I'd been turned down by every journalism school with the exception of the one I got into, was show them a pay slip from a local newspaper.
Oh.
And I said, I'm already working for my local free sheet. And here's my pay slips. Now, they didn't know that I was doing payroll for the paper boys because I didn't declare that. But I thought that's initiative.
That is initiative.
And that got me into journalism school. And then once I got into journalism school, it was like, shit, I need to get a job really quickly or I'm going to end up back home.
Where was home, by the way?
Cheltenham in Gloucestershire, in the Cotswolds, which is beautiful. But there was no industry there for journalism beyond the local evening newspaper, which I'd already gone and volunteered on. So I went and did this work experience and I just literally, you know, I did everything I could. I mean, I was like jazz hands, cartwheels. Do you want a coffee? Do you want a tea? Can I help? Can I be of any help to anyone? Excuse me, would you mind if I stayed late and watched you do this? And oh, could you show me this? Could you tell me more about yourself? I mean, I literally just, I was all over it.
Right.
And on the last day, there was a female editor there called Kate Hadley and she was just very nice. And it was really impressive to me that there was a woman as an editor, you know. And she said, yeah, no, I like you. Why don't you come back when you've finished your exams and you can be an editorial assistant here. And I was like, oh my God, thank you so much. It was £10,000 a year.
Yeah.
And so literally I took her quite literally at her word and I finished my exams, I think on a lunchtime. And by after lunch, I was at the office in some sort of hideous power suit that I'd got from my mum's catalogue, looking like Melanie Griffiths.
And working girl.
I mean, literally like shoulder pads. And when I walked in, they were all like, look at my jeans.
That's all right.
So yeah, that's what I did. And I started that. And I just literally, it felt like I had to constantly prove myself in order to remain in London, to remain in the business that I thought was meant for me. And I'd walked straight in, albeit kind of, you know, in a shadowy corner and, you know, to Fleet Street.
Yeah.
And from there, it's like opportunity knocks, right? So there was this big conversation there at the time about, oh my God, all the readers are dying. And the average age of the reader was something like 60. And, you know, and their children are not taking this newspaper forward as the family read.
Right.
So we need to bring in new readers, like younger readers. And who's young on the staff? And I literally was the only person under 30 that worked there. And they just went, well, would you like to write a column? And I would do like music reviews and a competition and an interview with a pop star. It was, it wasn't a particularly good column. And that got me noticed. The editor of that newspaper then became the editor of the Daily Mirror. And I went over there. And I'll be really honest with you, I hated it. It was not my kind of journalism. It was tabloid, you know. And and I was working crazy hours. You know, it's that kind of first in, last out mentality. I was like, God, you know, this is burnout city. And I was looking around me at women who are my age now who had no reason to hurry home.
Yeah.
Because they'd given everything to their the work. Newspaper, and I just thought, I don't want to be that.
Yeah.
So then I was chatting with a friend who was the editor of Smash Hits, who I really admired. And he said, you know, don't tell anyone, but I'm leaving. I was like, really? Who's going to get the job? I mean, I write a music column on a national newspaper. Maybe I should apply just for some interview experience because I've never had a job interview. And he said, well, you can give it a go. And I did. And I can't believe that they gave me the job, but they did. And from there on in, I became, you know, that girl that was the first editor of Smash Hits, who was a woman, who was the youngest person to sit in the chair. And I guess that gave me a headline. It gave me something to take out and work. And while I was there doing that job, and I was, you know, thrilled. It was my must-read magazine as a kid. I had to constantly give interviews to programs like News at 10 and be a spokesperson for the brand to try and raise awareness and increase sales. And we had a huge year for pop music. The Spice Girls imploded, Take That broke up, Jarvis mooned Jacko at the Brits, you know, Blur v Oasis. It was a big music year. So I just was popping up on stuff the whole time as the editor of Smash Hits, and I kept getting offered TV shows, and I didn't I had no desire whatsoever to be in front of the camera. I was an editor, and you know, I wanted to stay as, if not an editor, then a writer, and I wanted to transfer to the broadsheets and become, you know, a wordsmith that was admired and celebrated.
Can I ask you, though, back then, so there's been a lot recently, obviously, about Me Too and a lot of talk about women kind of coming up in male-dominated industries. Mm. What was your experience of that back in the... This would have been, what, the early 90s, right?
Yeah, very early 90s. I had one bad experience. One bad experience, that was it. That I mean, my first boss was a woman. She was amazing. Very pro-women. I worked for female editors. I didn't have a lot of bad experience. There was one guy in particular who was massively unprofessional in his treatment of me. And you know what? He got called out on it by Piers Morgan, actually, who turned out to be quite my hero.
Amazing.
Because he knew that this guy was giving me a really hard time, and he was coming in as an editor as I was about to leave to go and join Smash Hits. And he put that guy in his place.
Brilliant.
And he did it with full view of the newsroom. He
made a point.
With me stood next to him. He was actually, he was wonderful. Amazing. And I will always remain grateful to Piers for that. And he also taught me the importance of standing up for myself.
This is a big one. I've got a daughter, and I think one of the things of this campaign, because I think, look, some people experience it less, some people experience it more. We're a similar age. Again, I was lucky it didn't happen. But I think one of the things that always stuck in my mind was the importance of sticking up for yourself.
Totally. I mean, it's cost me a lot to do that. You know, principles come at a price, especially when you're working with very powerful people. But morally, I'm raising a child, you know, as you say, right? So I have to lead by example. I can't just say, do this, that's the right thing to do. I have to do it. And also, I have to live with myself. I'd rather be poor and honourable than rich and lacking in honour.
Absolutely. And I think, look, I think there's something about feeling entitled, though, to stand up for yourself, Kate. And I think that's what worries me. And I think this is especially the case for sort of, it's for both boys and girls, but I think especially women that are socialized into that you need to be likable and you don't want to let people down.
See, I never believed that. I mean, to give you an example, right? I never understood sexism until I went to work. It wasn't in my world.
Yeah. But I think for a lot of
for the main part in the world, that is...
it exists. We do...
I mean, the fact that women have only just been given the permission to drive in Saudi Arabia makes me want to vomit.
No, it
makes me angry.
Yeah. Well, look, that is horrific. But I think it's to me, the worry is, as a psychologist, is a kind of the nuanced way. I believe in life, you get what you think you deserve to some extent, right?
To some extent.
So if you're being, you know, socialized into thinking that you don't deserve to say that makes me feel uncomfortable, and you can, you know, and there's ways of saying it.
If you're talking about people being sexually motivated, I need a lawyer in the bollocks in the back of a cab who was working on a program that I was hosting and was very key to the power chain, I suppose, that wrapped around that hugely successful show. But you know what, you do not put your hands where he put them without me putting my knee in your crotch.
Damn right.
And
do you think that strength came from your experience with the bullying? That kind of, I'm not taking any
totally.
More shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And two parents. My dad, particularly, is hugely outspoken when he believes he needs to be, but otherwise entirely very quiet and passive. So I've seen the importance of picking your battles. And choosing them wisely, but knowing how to articulate yourself in those moments, be it with a raised knee to the crutch or a few sharp words. But yeah, I've always believed, and I really hope my son takes that from me, that you stand up for yourself, especially in the face of injustice. I hate injustice. I hate bullies. Hate them. But I also try to apply some compassion, because I think sometimes it's not just as simple as that's unkind and you're an unkind person. I think there's lots of underlying issues. So it's very it's a very cloudy grey area, will know only too well.
It is indeed. Fascinating. So at this point then, you're doing all this, then your TV career starts. Because I remember you presenting some of the really big shows. Was it X Factor or
Pop Idol and X Factor. Both. Yeah, I did, yeah. I mean, when I was at Smash Hits, I started to get offered lots of TV work, and I just kept saying no, you know. And then there was this one brilliant female producer who was so persistent. She just wouldn't let it lie. And her name was Trish Powell. And she worked for a regional arm of ITV called Meridian down in Southampton. And she'd asked me to come and host a new youth-based current affairs show for ITV. And I said, no, thanks. And then she came back and she said, I really think you're missing a trick. And she just was, she wouldn't let it lie. Yeah, and she said, will you at least meet me and let me put to you a business case for this? And I just found her quite undeniable with her persistence. Yeah. I said, okay, we'll have coffee. and I met her for a coffee and she just put it out there in a way that was really logical. You are working in an industry that is in decline, right? You've been brought into put up the sales of smash hits because it's declining. You've just come from a newspaper where all of the readers are dying and you were put in as a youth columnist to help bring younger readers in. So the decline and the decay is there. At that point, digital television was about to be launched. So we were living in a country where we had 5 channels, but they were about to become like 150. And she said, this is a growth industry. You're in a declining industry. If you come and work on this show with me, 3 things. One, no one's going to watch it. It's up against the EastEnders Omnibus. So, you know, your embarrassment about being on camera is, you're going to be seen by a handful of people. Well, a handful of thousands. But secondly, you'll learn every aspect of television production, from how to create a story, to shoot it, to edit it, to put music to it, to book studio guests off the back of it and present it. So don't get hung up on the presenting, because you will walk away from the end of this with a crash course in TV, and then you are qualified to go and work as an editor or a producer. So this is really future-proofing you. And I was like, wow, you're right. God, yeah. And at the same time, you know, everything she said made sense. She just was very, very seductive.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I had already by that point made a decision to move on from Smash Hits. And I'd signed up as a writer for the Sunday Times and for Marie Claire. So I was a freelance contributing editor. And I had time to do the show. And she was like, it's 13 weeks. Just suck it and see. Yeah. I thought, well, you know what?
Nothing to lose.
Nothing to lose. Yeah. So I moved into a Novotel with Nick Knowles in Southampton.
Okay. True story.
and we became the faces of this youth current affairs show that nobody watched until the 8th week. And we were on air on a Sunday. And in the very early hours of that Sunday morning, I was still awake reading my notes for the next day's show. I had the TV on in the background and the news was on. And the news was that there had been a terrible car accident in Paris, and that Princess Diana had been caught up in that. And I thought, there's no way that we're going to have a show tomorrow. I've only got 8 hours air miles. There's no way you could put somebody like me and Nick Knowles, who at that point was the regional kind of and finally guy on the local news. You can't leave us, you know, on air with that. But they did. And that became the moment that I just thought, I can't work anywhere else. That show, that 1 hour where we took over, I mean, everybody remembers, if you're of my age, where you were the day that you heard that Diana died. Yeah. And for me, it was on air doing a handover from Trevor MacDonald, having done 8 hours of telly in my entire life, interviewing the Prime Minister, cutting back and forth to Nick at Buckingham Palace, and just being swept up in this story that absorbed the world. You know, and that was it for me then. I was hooked. It was... the buzz was undeniable, despite the huge sadness of the story.
Of course.
Yeah, but as a kind of, you know, as a journalist, there's no place you'd rather be than at the heart of a major event.
Of course.
And that was it then. I was like, I'm never going to write about this stuff again. I'm going to talk about this stuff. And then bizarrely got a job on Top of the Pops.
But again,
and a Saturday night show called Don't Try This at Home. And then suddenly Kate Adey was like way in my past, and I was edging much more towards kind of, you know, a world of television that I never anticipated I'd end up in, but ended up loving.
Really enjoying it.
I loved Pop Idol. I loved X Factor. It was what I knew. You know, my Smash Hits head was firmly engaged. I knew pop music. I'd worked behind the scenes. I knew the process. The country was gripped by these shows. And again, I felt like I was the heart of a story that everybody was absorbed by. About... just nowhere near as important.
How did it feel, though, kind of getting that level of fame? So all of a sudden, people aren't just interested about what you're saying, but about who you are.
I don't know. It all got a bit too much at some points. But really, I was too busy to look up a notice. And this was in a time when, you know, I had a mobile phone then, but not everybody did.
Yeah.
And my phone had like a hand strap and an aerial that you had to pull up to receive calls. So there was no camera phone. There was no social media.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might get the odd negative piece of press, but just don't read it was always my stance. Like, you know, just don't read the TV reviews. Yeah, then you can't be hurt by them.
Yeah.
And also the shows that I was doing were so well loved that actually who can have an issue with somebody coming up to you in the street and just going, I love what you do, you know, and I love the show and tell me more about that. That's a beautiful way to live. I mean,
well, that's the lovely side. I'm talking about the side of people being interested in your private life. Who you're
that
dating,
came later. Yeah, that was hard.
Yeah.
That was hard. And then you realize many, many, many years later, it's been publicly, you know, written about. I, like many in my position at the time, was being hacked. So there would be massive details of your life that were bafflingly publicly available. And you're like, what's going on?
So you were one of the people who was being hacked? Mm. Oh, my Lord.
Mm. For many years, yeah. Whoa, okay. So that was a bit weird. Yeah. But you know what? As with all things in life, I really try to not dwell on the negatives. And there's very, you know, the very few negatives to doing a job you love that people enjoy you doing and you are rewarded handsomely for, that broadens your horizons, takes you around the world, and gives you a life that is beyond anything you thought was achievable as a troubled child being beaten the crap out of on a Wednesday at a bus stop in Cheltenham.
Absolutely.
So when you look at it like that...
Hear, hear.
You know, all right, and you're welcome to delve around in my private life. There's really not that much to tell, you know. I mean, I've never been particularly secretive about my private life because...
Most of the time I was so busy,
I didn't even have one.
But I think to me, it's not even about delving or in that sense. It's about kind of, I find it interesting how people used to have a private life and now with social media, they don't.
Yeah.
So when I used to work with celebrities,
it's quite interesting that you can control that now. I think actually, yes.
Control it now.
Well, I think you have far more authority and say over your own narrative. I mean, you can look at social media as being a negative and saying that everybody kind of vomits every detail of their life on a post. You can look at it and say that everybody vomits every, you know, detail of their life on a post. Or you can say that you have an opportunity to share what you're prepared to share and engage with an audience that have chosen to follow you and that you've chosen to engage with. And I don't have a bad experience with social media. People have been mostly really lovely and supportive. I've had the odd picture sent to me that you think, seriously, put your pants back on. But beyond that, I mean, and I don't get offended by that. It just gives me a laugh and I tend to share them on WhatsApp groups to my girlfriends. Just in case you were thinking of sending any more. So, you know,
I'm not sure I agree with you, though. I think now everyone has the shit side of celebrity, just without the great wardrobes and the limos. So I think it's all well and good saying, yeah, people send nice, for most of us, they send nice things. But actually, when you're a 15-year-old, well, I don't think it's our generation, really. I think which is why I was asking you about that time of your life.
I mean, I will not let my son on social media.
Because I remember we were the same, you know, same age group. I remember what was going on at that time. And there was a sense of, it was cool that I chose not to read something if I didn't want to. Whereas now I think that because it's disseminated much more quickly, it's disseminated everywhere, and it starts at such a young age, there's almost a sense of, for me to feel like I exist, you need to consume a part of me. And I think that's where I think we see a lot of mental health issues amongst the young. There's actually quite a bit of research around this as well.
I would agree entirely with that. And it is worrying, especially because so many young people are putting, as probably we did, but without the kind of coverage, such an emphasis on how you look and what you have. And actually, both of those things are massively unimportant. It's more about how you think and what you believe and what you do, by which you should be measured.
Yeah, yeah. And also having more nuanced discussions. I think what worries me is when you try and kind of analyze anything in 160 characters or less, or in a pic or in a hashtag, while it's very catchy.
Oh, it's impossible.
It's impossible. It's not nourishing emotionally. It's great.
A couple of lines.
Yeah, it's quick comebacks and quips, which are, no. But so tell me, I want to draw a lot of what you said today because I think it's fascinating. So I want to talk about with you, we've spoken about several sort of seminal moments in your life that have been just truly inspiring. But if you had to choose one moment that sort of a real seminal moment in your life that's kind of life-changing, what would that moment be?
Giving birth to my son. Oh. Because I was so incoherent, but so out of it by the time that he actually came. I can't remember enough about it, and I would love to go back and relive that. Ideally from the bit where he's born, not the actual pushing, because that was hell. But that first night of being a mum, everything changed. And I always say to my son, you put the colours in my rainbow.
Oh,
and that's so lucky. And that is exactly what he did. He made me feel differently about the world. He makes me think differently about the world. He educates me by simplifying life, and, you know, in a way that only children can, where everything is pretty black and white. And actually, as adults, we just cloud matters terribly. So he has been the most beautiful and wonderful thing that's ever happened to me. And so that has to be my moment.
Yeah.
And actually, when I struggle, you know, if I'm away working and I can't sleep, I lie there and I think about him being led next to me sleep, and he calms me. And that I find that very calming, because there is a purity to him. And I'm so proud of the child that he is, and the way that he thinks.
How old is he now?
He's 10.
He's 10.
Oh, yeah, he's 10. And so, and he still kisses me goodbye at the school gates in front of his mates. How long that will last, I don't know. But for now, I'm taking it.
Milk it for all it's worth. So he's an only child?
He's an only child. I raise him alone. He sees his dad, but he lives with me, and I have been his... I've been a single parent since he was 20 months old, which was also tough. And another defining moment. That was... So sometimes in life you make a decision and you think, yeah, there is no denying that that is a great decision. I think when you make a decision to do something like that, that's not so cut and dry. And you just think, please God, let this be the right decision. Please God, let me have made... And I'm not even religious, so I don't know why I'm saying please God. But please somebody make sure that this is the right decision. And I do believe now that it absolutely was the right decision. But that was tough. It was really tough being a single parent. You know, heartbroken, guilt-ridden, that I hadn't been able to make my family work. And then just juggling with the realities of it all.
Guilt's a crazy thing. I felt it from the moment I got pregnant.
Oh God, yeah.
Just kind of, it just you're thinking, oh my God, I had, you know, an extra piece of something to eat, and what if that somehow is affecting the brain biochemistry of this fetus? This is nuts.
It starts literally from the moment you see that blue line appear on your pregnancy test. I remember a gynecologist coming up to me, and I was about 6 months pregnant, and I was in Puerto Rico, and I was led by a pool on holiday. And I was eating shrimp tempura, and he came over and had a go at me and said, you realise that you are, you know, compromising the life of your unborn child. I was like, it's cooked fish.
Oh my God.
Get out of my face. I'm not eating sushi. I mean, but even, I was like, Jesus, I'm even being guilt tripped by the pool. And don't worry, I feel guilty enough already. The guilt never goes.
Oh God. No, and... Yeah, it is something. I had a friend that's a writer. She had the best quote about having a child. And I was like, what's it like? She said to me, it's like taking your heart out, putting arms and legs on it, and letting it run around. And
totally.
Like, that's it. That's exactly,
a great way to explain it. He stole my heart.
What's he like? Did you see yourself in him?
Yeah, he looks... he's the image of me and my dad, actually. He is. He's a really calm kid, which I never was. Okay. And he's really empathetic and kind. But then obviously I'm just sounding like every biased mother in the planet. He has been the easiest and most joyous part of my 45 years on this planet. He really has. I love him to pieces. He's my everything. He's my main man.
So when you kind of think about a comfort then, now this is your moment.
Mm.
What gets you through life? I'm sure a big part is thinking about the boy that puts colours in your rainbow. But what else are your things?
What if I need a bit of time out? Like, what's my escape?
What's not necessarily an escape, but what's in your toolbox, right? If you had to have, when you're going through a rough time, be it, you know, at work, be it just a stressful situation.
Okay.
What are the things you use?
My friends. Straight on the phone, lobbying for advice. Yeah. It's like a cabinet. I assembled the cabinet.
I love that.
Like, everyone to the war room. Let's set up a WhatsApp group for my latest dilemma. And you can all feed in. My girlfriends are amazing. And I have to say so myself, I've chosen friends wisely. And I'm very lucky that they've chosen to let me be their friends. Because I have the most amazing squad around me. that are just full of support, no judgment, amazing, smart, sassy, hilarious, loving women. So yeah, when the shit hits the fan,
that's what you do.
I call the cabinet.
Yeah, so I love it. I think we should say here as well, you're starting a podcast very soon called
With Those Women. Yes,
with these amazing, with the cabinet,
with the cabinet.
Best podcast.
It's the booze cabinet.
It's the booze. Literally, I love it. But it's called White Wine Question Time. I love that. So, and I guess again, I think there's something. You know, there's all this research about sort of social support, and it helps you, like when you have your cold, it gets better. Helps with cancer. Helps you live longer. There's like, you know, we know that. But I think there's something about sort of those female relationships, those bonds where you can really sort of laugh and at the same time feel that openness, that sense of, you know, because I think intimacy comes with vulnerability, right? And you feel safe to be open and vulnerable.
There's different emotions at play in those female friendships that you wouldn't get necessarily between, for example, you and your partner, your romantic partner. So for a start, resentment doesn't belong there, whereas in a relationship where you live together, be you woman and woman, man and man, man and wife, whatever, you become quite resentful towards one another. Well, your friends, just that just doesn't exist.
Well, in a good relationship you don't, though. A good partnership,
but,
though.
Yeah, but you know, that bickering, you know, especially when, you know, you've just had a baby and everybody's, you know,
competitive sleep.
Hey, I've had 2 hours sleep. Let's compete about who's more tired and who can be more unreasonable. So you don't have that with your friends. It's far more, the emotions that wrap themselves around a female friendship, in my experience, are just really supportive and non-judgmental. And, you know, they laugh. So when you've done something terrible or behaved in a way that, you know, I mean, recently I was snappy to somebody at parents' evening. And a lovely woman. I was just having a really bad day. And, you know, I was able to phone her afterwards and go, I'm so sorry. I'm hormonal as hell. This has happened today. Blah, blah, blah. And she was like, oh, do you want to pop round for a glass of wine? Rather than, well, you know, I mean, we're just very collaborative and supportive. That's, and so forgiving. Forgiveness is a really big thing.
It's a huge one. I think there's something as well about, I'm an only child, so I'm a huge proponent of friendship because I kind of feel people are there because they want to be, not because they have to be. I think with families, it's like, call your cousin, you know, go to your sister's
house.
Whereas, you know, a friend,
friends are the family you choose.
Yeah, and there's something in that idea that you're there because you wanna. There's no
totally, and because you love that person.
You love them, yeah.
And, you know, and I do. I genuinely am. My female friendships, two date back to the age of 11, and they are still two of the closest women in my life. I love them both. And they were the girls that got me through those really tough years of being bullied at school. They were the friends that appeared on my horizon and just gave me friendship. Amazing. You know, that's probably the first recall I have of what it is to be liked and have a friend. Well, not liked, but to have a genuine friend. And then subsequently, the women that are my friends that kind of form the booze cabinet, they're women that predominantly I've met through work.
Okay.
The sisterhood, you know. And they're just awesome. And I love them. And they've outlived and outlasted every relationship I've had romantically. Wow. So any new boyfriend that comes in, you know, my boyfriend now, he gets it. He's like, yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. Yes, yes, yes. You love them more than you love everyone else. It's like, no. Not, it's just I love them. I do, and I'm not afraid to say to any of them, I love you, I couldn't be here without you. Because they mean the world. They do mean the world.
So in terms of those, that's the kind of the social support. How about when you're on your own and you're going through a hard time? We were speaking earlier and you were saying this.
No,
you said wine, but as I say, you know, let's not self-medicate. No. We're not getting that advice.
No, actually, I don't do that. In fact, when I'm in the eye of a storm, I tend to down tools on anything that will put me in an altered state. So I won't touch the wine.
Yeah.
I liked, you know.
Which is very clear, yeah.
I mean, for example, became a single parent. It was so hurtful and so painful that no self-medication was going to help. I just thought, right, this is going to hurt and I've just got to feel my way through it. And a glass of wine is only going to prolong the inevitable. So let's just go through this, literally, you know, ball up my hands into fists and just get through this as quickly as I can. Learning about yourself as well, you know, trying to take some lessons from it, because I refuse to keep repeating the mistakes of the past. Otherwise, the definition of that is insanity.
But I think that's what came across when we were speaking earlier as well, is that you thirst for learning. You're an avid reader. You do courses. You do kind of, there's always something about that kind of
I'm interested in life, right? I don't want to stand still. I don't feel like, you know, I think as a kid, we used to look at people of our age now and go, oh, well, they've stopped, right? We're grown up now. It's like when your feet stop growing, your brain shouldn't, your interest in life shouldn't.
Absolutely.
The world is changing around us, and I'm so curious that I still want to keep pushing myself, and I'm just hungry for experience, knowledge, and I don't really want to spend the rest of my life in the next 20 years doing what I did over the last 20 years. I want new experiences.
Absolutely.
Why would you want to
do the same thing?
I don't
over
get
and
it, over. Right? You know, and some people do.
Yeah.
But I just don't. It's like having the same sandwich every day. No thanks. I had tuna yesterday.
I'm good. Yeah.
Yeah, now where's the salami? Yeah, I want something. I want different tastes and flavors, because that's what keeps you interesting as well.
But I think that also suggests a quiet confidence in you and a hopefulness about the future, because one of the things I think that stops people from moving forward is that anxiety, right? Is that
confidence.
It is confidence.
I mean, don't get me wrong. If I suddenly sat here now and went, I know I'm going to be a brain surgeon. I know I can't do that. I'm not that bright. All that interested. And I'm probably never going to be a barrister, but I would like to have been. I would like to have had the chance to challenge myself educationally to see how far I could go. But that just wasn't an option. And, you know, I really got time on my side and I have to go and train for 7 years to become a barrister. But there are certain things that, you know, I think, yeah, I can do that. I can do it. I can try to do that.
Yeah.
So I'll just give it a go.
Yeah.
And do my, you know, when I apply myself to something, I give it everything. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I'm never half-arsed about it. Unless I'm hungover in the gym, and then I am. But fundamentally, yeah, if I identify something that I think I might be able to do.
Then you really do it. You either do it or you don't.
Totally.
Yeah.
100% in, or just really not bothered at all, yeah.
So what's the next challenge? What's on the, where's your compass pointing? Where's North?
It's really interesting. I don't know. And I don't think it's for me to decide. You know, my professional life has never been decided by me. It's been really decided for me by opportunity,
sure,
or lack of. So I really don't know what comes next. I just want to keep getting out of bed, as I did today, going, I'm coming to your house, which is lovely, by the way.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to have a conversation that I wouldn't otherwise have in my day.
Yeah.
And that's new, and that's different to what I did yesterday. And it's certainly different to what I'm going to do tomorrow. And that, for me, feels like winning right now.
Oh, Kate, I could speak to you forever. Thank you so much.
No, it was
fascinating. And I can't wait to listen to you clinking glasses and talking about life with your lovely
group
of friends.
With the booze cabinet.
With the booze cabinet. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
So that was Kate Thornton. It was a real pleasure speaking to her. And again, check out White Wine Question Time. It was a great podcast. In the meantime, I really hope you're enjoying this podcast as much as I am. We've got some amazing guests lined up for 2019. I think we started great with Kate, but we've got some fabulous topics and fabulous guests coming forward. So please, you know, rate, review, subscribe. And also, if there's someone that you think I should get on the podcast or a topic you want to talk about, let me know and I'll make sure I do it. Until we meet again, I want to wish you a very healthy, happy body and mind.